I give computer bits to the computer, and then a behind the scenes, a group of gnomes, mechanical Turks, paint a JPEG with brushes, and then they put it on the website. Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris, professional figure skater. Coyer. Hi, Chris.
How are you doing? No, I don't think I've ever put skates on before. But we have a guest who absolutely has, as well as has dug into deep into the world of how CSS actually operates, and that's Amy Knight. Hey, Amy, how are you?
Good. How are you guys?
Fantastic. So, yeah. Gosh, where should we start? Certainly, I wasn't planning on talking about figure skating.
But Go for it. No, that's a big part of my, it's kind of part of my story. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Tell us about yourself and who you are and what's going on.
Okay. So, I'll try to keep this like under 60 seconds, but a lot of people know me as like this girl who used to figure skate that got into programming. I also do this podcast called JavaScript Jabber every week, and people may know me from there. But I spent most of my life doing that. And then after college, just kind of realized that, you know, I wasn't skating anymore. And I really just needed like a new passion in life. And I stumbled into programming, actually stumbled into CSS first. And we can talk about that in a minute. But started tweaking CSS here and there for my employer's CMS, and kind of the rest is history. So fast forwarding a little bit though, like I went to a boot camp and, you know, got my first job. I was doing full stack, and then specifically kind of like what I wanted to, you know, talk about today. So I did full stack JavaScript for, I don't know, 2-ish years. And then I started at Warner Brothers, and it was the first time that I switched to just a front end role. And I realized, you know, when I got into programming, CSS was like, there was a very like low barrier to entry there. But that like learning curve goes up pretty quickly. And at some point in my progression as a developer, like the role switched where initially I was scared of, you know, JavaScript and felt good about CSS. And then at some point I was like terrified of CSS and felt really good about my JavaScript. And when I got to a company like Warner Brothers, you know, I was working before that at some like startups and then like some more established companies. And, you know, whether we had somebody specifically that was in charge of doing the styles or not, you know, there's always kind of like a wiggle room where if you can't get it exactly like, you know, somebody had wanted you to do, you know, that was okay. But with a company like Warner Brothers, you know, the functionality in JavaScript is really important at other places. But at Warner Brothers, like the way that it looks is their brand, and it is just as important as the functionality. So it's in that.
You can't have a $25 million movie and a $6 website.
Right? Yes. Like I just realized like how poor my CSS skills were. And I felt really like helpless. Like they would hand me, you know, we would get like a mock-up from the designers. And I was like, how can I call myself a front-end developer if I am, you know, I can write the JavaScript, but I can't do these complex layouts without getting help from, you know, other more senior CSS-focused people?
What a unique position to be in. I mean, in that, well, not unique. I guess it's unique for this show in a way, if anything, it's usually the other way around when we talk to guests, right? Or that there's a, you know, like I get the HTML and CSS stuff, but the JavaScript stuff eludes me more. You're kind of a representative of this opposite, you know, chunk of the world of people who are quite comfortable in JavaScript land and found themselves in a position where they're just like, ay, 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 with the CSS. And it's particularly hits right now because there's just more and more people in that position, and we're starting to see it manifest with, you know, industry-wide drama of these type of developers inventing tooling to just avoid CSS entirely, yeah, and stuff like that. And that's probably a drama that will persist for a long time, but you kind of maybe have some sympathy in a way for that world.
Yeah, I mean, so kind of like my mindset there was, you know, I was very much like the developer who would try to write some CSS to, you know, make things look that the way that they wanted it to look. And I felt like I was just like blindly throwing darts at a dartboard, like just guessing. I didn't understand how it worked. And because I didn't understand, I was like, well, this is silly, you know, JavaScript rules. And which, you know, sometimes I feel like that.
I think you even mentioned during a talk that you had some debugging. You felt like you could debug JavaScript all day.
Yeah.
Like your tooling for that is great. Yeah. But if there's, you know, if you're just throwing dirt at the wall with CSS or whatever, that's not true CSS debugging.
Exactly. And, you know, my manager at the time at Warner Brothers, he kind of like forced me to, you know, if we were like in a grooming section and, you know, figuring out what to do the next sprint, you know, if we had like a ton of JavaScript, you know, related tickets and then a ton of CSS, he was like, you need to take the CSS. So, you know, he kind of said, you know, why not, like, if you really want to like understand this stuff better, like he knew my personality, why not really try to dig in at a deeper level? And, you know, coming from JavaScript land, I'm a big fan of Kyle Simpson. And one thing that he says is you should always be able to like understand things at the next lowest level of abstraction. And so like what he means by that is if you're working in React, you should have like a, you know, good understanding of JavaScript itself. And so, you know, like what does that necessarily mean for CSS? Like maybe if you're working with a framework, like you would want to understand, you know, the styles there. But like for me, I was just writing like plain old CSS. So like the next lowest level was like understanding how the browser was actually like reading my style sheets and that kind of thing.
That's, yeah. There's probably a good amount of us who think we're about as low as we want to go at raw CSS. You know, be like, I don't know, that's pretty low already, you know. But no, in fact you've done some research and can you walk us through that, like you know your experience with learning how that works, right? That you've dug into and researched how browsers, you know, parse a document and all that. Do you want to teach us, maybe? That would be our...
I could give like maybe the cliff notes, because I'm sure like maybe this is review for some people, and I also don't want to like, you know, say stuff too much where people, you know, like reading through documentation slowly might be better for some listeners, but than sure, me just kind of babbling on. But I can go over it at a high level and talk about like what I did to understand this stuff, which might be like the most valuable thing.
Your approach might be interesting.
Yeah, so there are some great resources, and I can give you guys links to all those. So if other people want to go check them out later, but like one of the resources that I used is there is a YouTube channel called Blink On, and it is like a conference that Google does every year for the developers who work on Blink, which is the rendering engine for Chrome. And so I just like, I would watch those videos and I kind of like had to watch them a couple of times, a lot of them, because there are so many concepts like flooding in that I was not familiar with. So use that and, you know, tried to, there's some, unfortunately, like a lot of the material that I found was older, but, you know, it was still helpful from a high level. And then also coming from, you know, I don't have a traditional computer science background, so just understanding like at a high level, like how, you know, how things are parsed and rendered in that whole process, because that wasn't something, you know, as a self-taught person or bootcamp person, that wasn't something that, you know, they spent a lot of time on, because they kind of, I guess, try to quote unquote focus on stuff that's a little more practical than going low into that.
Yeah, right. You're probably not going to get a job because you roll into an interview and you're like, well, can I tell you how the browser turns CSS into the CSS or whatever?
Like, yeah. Yeah. So like even that, I, you know, like being in JavaScript, I was definitely familiar with, you know, the document object model, but I had never heard of like the CSS object model. And Like, just understanding, I guess I can go into that a little bit.
I would think few of us are, right? Like, there's a lot of us are aware that your HTML turns into the DOM because we need to, I don't know why that's a common thing, but I think people just know that. They know that JavaScript can affect the DOM. They know that, you know, when they open DevTools, they're kind of basically looking at the DOM and that is a bit different than the document that they sent across in HTML. All kinds of things can affect it. That's like somewhat common knowledge, like maybe not for everybody, but I feel like the CSS on is anything but common knowledge. So
maybe I can explain my understanding of it and then Amy can try and then we can see who does it better.
Yeah, let's do that. you guys are going to teach me stuff, I'm sure.
I give computer bits to the computer and then a behind the scenes, a group of gnomes, mechanical Turks, paint a JPEG with brushes and then they put it on the website. That's how I understand it to work. Amy, maybe you try. We'll vote on who's better.
Yeah, can we just go with that? I like that. Yeah. okay. So my understanding, slightly different, is, you know, like I said, at a high level, you know, the browser has to like, you know, and this is its own, this is, you know, another whole process, but at a high level, like the browser is going to parse, you know, the HTML page and your CSS page, but that does those, like, those are two separate, you know, and those are two separate like models to the browser. So it has to construct the CSS object model and it has to construct the DOM. And once it's constructed those and it like mashes those two together into something called the render tree. And then the render tree, like you were saying, Chris, is, you know, that's what we're actually going to be kind of debugging, because that is like the CSS object model can obviously, if we think about it, when we are writing our CSS, it can kind of reorder the DOM, and JavaScript too can reorder the DOM. So it can, you know, take this tag and move it, you know, off the page or move it in a different order, or, you know, that kind of thing. So we have to have the render tree, because that's like the visual output that the user is going to see.
I didn't quite know that the render tree is kind of considered like the DOM plus the CSM smashed together.
Yep.
Okay, so that's cool.
I don't know. And then one other thing that was like interesting to me, you know, as somebody, again, who didn't have a computer science degree and was kind of starting to, you know, try to understand this stuff at a little bit lower level and, I don't know, nerd out a little bit because I like doing this kind of thing. like understanding that there's a lot of code within the browsers that are responsible when it's parsing HTML. You know, we can just think of like a lot of like if statements, because the browser is going to render our HTML even if it's like ill-formed. So there's a lot of code within the browser to do that, and which means the HTML parser is not a conventional parser. Our CSS is very different. You know, when we write our CSS, it has to be valid. So if we like miss a curly brace or something like that, the browser is just kind of like going to say, well, nope, can't do anything. Here's your error. And so the CSS parser is a conventional parser. So, you know, I knew that.
That's funny. Yeah, I wrote a post recently about like the implications of screwing up CSS syntax a little bit. And it's funny that I didn't really think of it the way you're explaining it, but it like if you miss a closing bracket, it like basically like keeps going until it finds one. So it's like, it's not like you can have some errors in your CSS, but it's not very forgiving, and that it basically tries to find complete chunks of valid CSS in which to apply, and that anything that isn't valid, it doesn't throw an error, but it does totally ignore that piece, which is a pretty bad error.
Yep. So that, I don't know. That was interesting to me. So in my talk, I give this visual of like back to the skating thing. So like I think of HTML as like the skater who can like Bambi on the ice, and then CSS is kind of more like I try to be when I got better at skating. Graceful.
I'm just abstracting. when people, I say people, but browser people kind of are like, oh, they're, you know, too many CSS selectors, all that. Don't do that because that's bad. That is because it creates a gigantic CSS OM, and then with a more gigantic CSS OM, when you try to marry it with the DOM into that render tree, that seems it's just more expensive because you have two giant things, probably not just one giant.
Yeah. And then two, we think about like most things in the browser are a recursive process. So if it has to go through that over and over and over again, you're thinking about like how big, like just, yeah, again, how expensive that's going to be when I have to like recurse over something multiple times.
So once you understood kind of how the CSS object model works, like what was the next hardest thing, like coming from like JavaScript landia? You have like an Angular background, is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, okay. Yeah, Angular, a lot with Angular 1. I haven't done much with Angular. I don't know what they're on now, but we'll say post Angular 1. I'm actually back in React land and did a little bit of Vue at Warner Brothers. But so at that point, I think like once I kind of got into that, I was like, okay, like I understand this enough. I've gone deep enough. I probably do want to get like a little bit more practical here. And I think I put like a Twitter poll out and tried to see what things tripped JavaScript developers up the most about CSS. And then those were the things that I, yeah. So positioning, obviously, which is like a big one. I feel like Flexbox helps with that a lot. But then specificity and z-index. So for me, specificity and z-index, I learned a lot about that, that, you know, some listeners may be aware of already, but as somebody who like really just focused on JavaScript, I had no idea. So like specificity, I would, you know, put a bunch of selectors on something and have it like, you know, try to pull up my page and refresh and I don't see it doing anything. I'm like, why is this not working? And like with JavaScript, you know, I would go about debugging something very systematically. And, you know, what I learned by like digging into CSS is you, especially with specificity, you can go about it the exact same way, like just be very systematic and, you know, actually understand kind of what the rules are for the different selectors and maybe even just like writing it down on a piece of paper, you know, what my calculation is there. And then as far as the index, like I had never heard of what a stacking context was. So once I had a better understanding of that, then I was able to like better understand Z index and actually like debug some Z index issues. So
nice. Nice. So you could, so if, you know, like, if you're trying to avoid CSS somehow, there's no way to avoid layout. Like at some point you just need, no matter how you apply CSS to a page, you're still gonna have to learn how layout operates. But you might be able to avoid specificity. There's probably a couple of different ways in which that you could totally skip that learning process in a way. But
Well, I was going to say, too, like, one thing I talk about in this talk that I give that's, like, my argument for why it's important for, you know, JavaScript developers to focus on CSS, like, with a lot of the new stuff coming out, like, Flexbox is way more performant. Not only is it, you know, do I like it better from a usability standpoint as a developer, but, like, it's actually much more performant than just using a floated layout. I should back up, too, and say, like, one other thing that I learned a lot about, which... like everybody talked about hardware acceleration and I had no idea what that meant. So now I have a better understanding of like that means compositing and how compositing fits into all this. So.
Isn't that one reason you might find yourself where you dug in for kind of different reasons, like this idea of trying to understand CSS at a lower level, but another path into this that people where people might land themselves where you are is because of stuff like that, because they're really performance concerned. Yep. And if you're really performance concerned, you care about things like hardware acceleration and how the browser does what it does so that you can, you know, make choices to make it faster if you can. So part of this is stuff like, you know, we got as far as the render tree, but there's other stuff that happens, right? Like this idea of painting.
Yep. And yep. So we go, yeah, so I can go into that just a little bit. So like at a high level, once we have the render tree, then the browser goes through layout, paint, and composite in that order. And so layout is like determining the position and size of everything. Paint is, you know, just like we say, like painting, like actually drawing the pixels. And then composite is when it's going to like have these painted parts that are put together. And so, like if we think about, like one thing I learned when I was doing this is, you know, rather than, there are multiple ways that I can like hide something on the screen. And the best, the most performant way to do that would be opacity, because opacity is not going to trigger layout and paint. It only uses the composite step. And also, like, painting is the most expensive, so you would want to avoid that. So by digging into this kind of stuff, you know, I learned, like, you know, what properties were better to use, because, like, changing the opacity of something only runs composite. And that's going to, you know, be hardware accelerated, because those two go hand in hand.
Actually makes a lot of sense. So it paints some things, but the paint process doesn't paint the entire screen as you see it. It paints like parts of the screen. Is that what? And then the compositing is taking pieces that have been painted and putting them together.
Yep.
So if you change the opacity or you change the size or whatever through transform, that piece that's already been painted doesn't change. It only changes how it combines.
Yeah. So it only has to run that composite step, which the same thing with like,
I never really understood that. Thank you.
And that's about,
I was like, how does it not have to repaint? Like, this giant piece is like moving up and over and overlapping these other pieces. How is that not involve paint?
Yeah.
It seems very paint-like, but it doesn't, because it's not. It's compositing. That's fascinating.
I know. So, you know, you have taught me so much, so I'm glad that I could help you a little bit. That might be the one time.
I like how you, like, approach this from, like, a performance and even just kind of a, you know, like, your, it's very, like, engineering-oriented, it feels like.
Yeah, exactly, because I've been fortunate enough to work with, like, so many great mentors, you know, over my career. And, you know, like, at one point somebody made the analogy of, like, if you're debugging something and you want to think about it, like, what do investigators do? They don't just, like, go over, like, this crime scene, like, haphazardly. Like, they don't just, like, go all over the place. They pick, like, one little area and debug that area, like, one thing at a time, meaning it's, like, a very systematic approach. And so that's kind of the approach that I took whenever I debug something in JavaScript is, you know, what are the minimum amount of variables that I need to reproduce this issue, and so that I can, you know, just, like, kind of isolate something. And with CSS, like, honestly, for me, the number one problem I was facing is that I just didn't understand how stuff was working, even at a very high level. Like, without even going deep into this stuff, I didn't understand. And so my ability to systematically debug something was severely limited. It was just a lot of guessing, which is not systematic at all.
So brought that debugging, that's a part of this whole journey. And so some of it was specificity stuff. Maybe we'll continue down that path. But one of them was like Z-index, you mentioned, and that's not just a problem. That's a problem for everybody, right? That's a tough one, and a common one that's a problem. So, like, this stuff helps kind of, this deep dive helps kind of inform how you, like, let's say you literally get a ticket that's like, there's a Z-index problem.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what do you do?
Sweat is rolling down my face from, like, anyways. But yeah, okay. So debugging something in Z-index. So for me, like, the first thing was to understand, like, you know, I know what Z-index is. Like, it means that it's going to, you know, put something in front or behind of another element. But apart from that, like, my understanding just kind of stopped there initially.
Probably does for a lot of people. It's just a number. Why doesn't the higher number always win? I mean, that's the core.
10 million. Yeah. Z-index 10 million.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's a couple issues here. So the first thing is, like, you know, you're actually limited on the value that you can give your Z index because of the browser's programming language. Like, so there's like the max signed value of a 32-bit integer. Like, I should have the number memorized, but like, that's the maximum value that you can give your Z index because, like, literally the browser can't make it go any higher than that. So that's one. Right. So that's one thing.
I got it here. Then, I got it. It's hold on.
Oh, I should have this memorized. Hold on. Like
2,147,483,647.
There you go.
I wish.
I guess 48 if you count zero as a
there you go. So that's like number one. So apart from that, though, because that's kind of silly, is understanding what a stacking context is. Because I've given this talk a couple times, and I actually like talked to one developer. They're like very senior developer, like engineering lead on their team, and they got stuck on a Z index issue for like 3 days. And the problem was that there are
certain. I know what it is. I can already guess what it is.
But okay, okay. Yeah.
I'll write it. I'm going to write it down on this piece of paper.
You probably do know what it is. But there are certain properties besides the index that are going to trigger a new stacking context. So in this case, they were applying a transform to something and they didn't realize that that was creating a new stacking context. So backing up, though, to understand stacking context and I'm reading. Yep, exactly. I can see for everybody listening. That's exactly what Chris wrote down.
It's because transforms cause a new stacking context thing, and that's impossibly weird to know. And it screws up everybody ever.
Yep, anyways. Understanding when I'm debugging something, and you can actually like in Chrome go in, there's a layers tab that will allow you to see the stacking context that you're in. So like we want
really?
Yeah. You can totally just add this in Chrome. There's a layers tab under like if you go over on the right for like those like extra features that aren't there by default. But it'll let you see the stacking context there. But anyways. So, like, to understand that, to understand what stacking context is, when you add a Z index, when you add Z index to something and you give it, like, an actual value, then you're triggering a new stacking context, which means that anything that is a child of that, they're going to, like, move backwards and forwards together. And then if you're outside that stacking context, obviously, like, you cannot make your specific element try to move in front or behind of something outside of another stacking context. So if you're applying a z-index on some, all that to say, if you're applying z-index to something and you can't get it in front or behind of whatever you're trying to get it in front or behind of, go into your developer tools and make sure that the two elements that you're looking at are within the same same stacking context.
Yeah, and if it's okay, that's awesome advice. And so you got to look at its parent. What's going on with the parent? You look at the parent's parent. What's going on with the parent's parent? What's going on with the parent's parent's parent? It's nice that there's some visual thing that just shows you where which element has applied the new stacking context. But this can be an exceptionally painful because even if you have debugged it, you might find that parent's parent parent has a transform on it, which is the thing that's screwing you up. But it can't not. You can't just remove the transform, you know? So then you're like, what do I do? Do I got to somehow move this thing out of that parent? And, you know, I don't know.
I don't have advice there.
Quite tricky. Yeah.
That might require actually higher level decisions.
Yeah. Like, I think that's why, like, tooltip libraries and stuff often, like, they don't put the tooltip semantically right next to the thing that's triggered the tooltip. They put it like as a child of the body because they just don't even want to deal with.
Interesting.
It's funny that way, because you can just do some JavaScript math to figure out where that element is rendering itself and then just move it next to it, which might be an accessibility fail, but at least it's a Z index success and whatnot.
I like that. Z index success.
I just pulled up my client site in this layers panel, which is awesome. I forgot it existed. It's beautiful. I mean, there's a lot of it draws little boxes around everything. And there's like the 9999 negative 9999 pix hack, that's like hiding something way off the screen. And it is bad. It is like, it doesn't like that. It paints it red because it's just so mad at it. So this is very interesting. Oh, and I can rotate it in 3D. Tab? Oh, no, you go to the shish kebab menu, and then you go to more tools, and then you go to layers. Oh, yes, yes. Or in the dev tools shish kebab. There's two shish kebabs.
Right, the dev tools one. Yeah, and then it says document, and then it just lists all your contexts, I guess. Yep. So I just happen to be looking at a YouTube page, and there's all these, like, buttons. Even a button can Because this button probably toggles back and forth with transforms. So it has a transform on it. Thus, it's got a new context.
Yeah, like so much of those like dev tools are pretty helpful. Like I feel like there's a level of education just to get familiar with them. Like especially some of those that are more hidden. But like, you know, because all I used to ever do was like, you know, asterisk border 1 pixel. You know, solid,
yeah.
You know, like give everything a border so I can get an idea of like where things are, but that doesn't really work for like Z index and stuff like that.
Yeah, that does lead us into that's interesting. Is I often think of like, oh, debugging CSS, that 100% happens in whatever browser you're in's dev tools. Like I think 98% of CSS debugging happens there, but not 100%. Right, because sometimes you just need a little bit more help, like putting borders around everything.
Yep.
Might be just the answer to figuring something out in a way. Do you have other stuff like that?
I don't. So, you know, thinking about this, honestly, for me, the best tool I had was just a better understanding. Like I keep just like hitting home on that point, but I don't. You know, I have like a whole another like level of respect for people who are just like CSS whiz kids because, you know, it does take time to learn CSS, and it is like a very respectable thing. And it's not a fun feeling to not be able to, you know, understand what exactly is going on. And so like the best thing that you can do apart from like these dev tools is just like really take the time to, you know, learn some of this stuff. If you're a front end developer and, you kind of like shrug off CSS, I would kind of challenge you nicely to maybe reconsider. Mm-hmm.
I suppose the things like dev tools get more useful the more you know about CSS too. Like if you totally kind of don't get Cascade, I don't know, like I open the dev tools and I look and I'd be like, oh, I see this selector is overriding this other selector because I can see both selectors at thatch, and then dev tools like crosses out the one that is being overridden. And you just kind of know that, oh, yeah, that's because specificity. But if you had no idea what specificity was or why, that's not very useful.
Yeah, like I know one of the biggest things that I learned from like digging into the specificity stuff was like, you know, we have like code smells in whatever like language you're using, but like, you know, important is definitely a code smell. And if I see like important on something, you know, usually it kind of like triggers me to think, you know, do we just like not understand the specificity here? And do we really need this?
I think you maybe mentioned it in your talk, or I saw it on Twitter recently, Amy, but animating, for example, you know, if you animate kind of what we talked about before, if you animate opacity or you animate the transform, you don't incur the paint, like, what is it? Paint.
Yeah. You don't have to go through the paint process. Yep.
Composite. And so like, you know, if you do, like, so those animations, because they have two less steps, it's less expensive and it's way more performant. You're more likely to hit and maintain 60 FPS. And, you know, it's stuff like that. If you didn't know that and you're just like, well, to hide this thing, I'm just going to margin left it and zip it 9,000 pixels off the page. Like, you know, you didn't know you were doing a bad, you know, and that's fine. But it's those kind of, as you kind of dig in, you can kind of learn like, oh, there's, you know, better ways of doing things.
Yeah, I think like, you know, kind of what I try to, you know, encourage people with the talk and stuff is that, you know, there's like a lot of people are super excited about like all the, you know, new like JavaScript frameworks and all the like cool stuff that's coming out there. But, you know, try to pay attention, or, you know, don't forget there's some really exciting stuff coming out with like CSS. Like, I don't want to change topics too much, but like I am like super excited about like learning more about Houdini, which I know you guys talk about that a little bit too. So,
I just today, I think that we're recording this, Surma from Chrome Dev posted a masonry in like 50 lines of Houdini.
Oh, and
yes. And
is that showing that, because this is what I know about Houdini, it's very little, but there's lots of parts to Houdini. And the first thing that dropped was this idea of paint, mm-hmm. which kind of was like, all the demos are very cool, but they're like basically a way to paint a canvas and a background image.
Yeah,
essentially.
Paint
that's, and that's not layout.
Canvas in CSS, sort of.
Sure, and that's cool, and there's all kinds of powerful crap you can do there, I imagine, you know? But like, that's not layout. Layout seems like a kind of a bigger unlocking of possibility.
Yeah, I think...
Is that true, or do I have that wrong?
No, you're right. I mean, it's still buggy and stuff like that, but basically you just pass in some CSS variables, like at this width, I want it to be this many columns. At this width, I want it to be this many columns. And then it'll lay it out. It's basically a layout algorithm that in 50 lines of JavaScript that works. So
I was confused for a while because I thought it was that canvas stuff. I was like, oh no, are we going to ultimately end up having to like paint masonry with canvas, you know, but that's not it.
No, I don't think it's, I think it's like actual DOM elements. It just is their positioning and widths and all that stuff is kind of like handled by this layout, you know, API.
I think, and man, I could be wrong. So we may or may okay, not. Okay,
you say your understanding and we'll vote on it.
but I think, like, as part of this paint stuff too, I could be confusing. I've watched a bunch of these talks, and I could be confusing a few things. But I think part of it too is like they can do this in a whole separate process, so they can speed things up that way. Like we have web workers, and now we're going to have stuff like that for CSS.
Yeah, I think you're right because the I guess the plugins are called worklets. Like,
yep.
So I
yep.
think they by sort of that definition, they kind of work in a separate thread. Yeah, very interesting.
Might as well be performant while we're doing it, you know.
This Canary demo that Surma wrote up, I mean, I opened it up and I, you know, squeezed the hell of it in the browser, you know, as you do. That's yep. what you're supposed to do when you're testing things. And I mean, there may be paint frame things going on, but like you can really give it a squeeze. And when you give like masonry, with David DeSandro, really great, awesome tool. But like when you get that going, it really starts crashing your computer, you know? So it has a tough time with that when you just start just shaking the hell out of the browser. So it's, I don't know. It's all very, very interesting.
This is whack-a-doodle-doo. Are you looking at these 50 lines of code? It's like, weird.
I know what I'm doing tonight now.
I tried to read it. I feel so dumb. There's like a star layout, like star function name. And
is that?
I don't know. Maybe Amy knows. Is that a generator? It looks like a generator.
Sounds like, yeah. I'd have to look, but yeah, it sounds like it.
But then, it's like, okay, I kind of get generators. But then like, why is it a generator? I don't really know. Probably because it just kind of keeps calling itself. So I don't know. But so I got to really into this code on, I don't know.
And it's performing math, which you'd expect it to do. But then there's functions in there like layout next fragment. You're like, what is that? You know? So it's one of these things where it's not just like Houdini's a thing. It's like much like CSS Grid or whatever. There's 100 things you have to know.
Or like service workers, you know, like it's like, oh, there's like already methods in here that I need to know. Okay, cool.
There's so much.
It's awesome.
I'm like excited about, you know, like actually being able to like implement new features. And I don't know, I haven't like really focused too far into that yet to understand, like, I don't know, like my imagination could go wild. Like what exactly could you do? But the fact that you can... Like, I kind of think of, like, Houdini as, like, the Babel for my CSS. I'm just like, that's so cool.
That's a great way to look at it. Because JavaScript moves fast because it has things like Babel to try out stuff. Babel's, I mean, I know that, I don't know what Babel's philosophy is about. They probably, like, don't just put any old crap in there, right? It's generally like future coming ideas or whatever.
Yeah.
But I suppose you could use that framework to do something really weird if you wanted it to, because it's a, I don't know.
Like experiment with stuff.
You just
Yeah, like
experimental stuff, right? Well, how do you do experimental stuff in CSS? You got to write a CSS parser? I don't think so.
Yeah, like I feel like this is going to allow people, you know, potentially, like, you know, what they do now with JavaScript is like they can kind of vet some of these things before, you know, they actually ship in browsers to see if, you know, if they're valuable to the community. So now we can kind of do the same thing with CSS where, you know, if somebody has a need or they think something is going to be super valuable, then they can kind of play with it with, you know, implementing it via Houdini, like, because they're making these APIs available, and then, you know, then the browsers can go and implement it if the community thinks it's valuable.
That's the magic, isn't it? Like, do you think it's really going to, you know?
I think so. And I don't know, what excites me about it is just, like, I keep going back to what I was saying where, you know, I came into Warner Brothers and, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, JavaScript's so cool and, you know, and CSS, I don't know about this, but like, I just gained so much respect for, you know, some of the, you know, more CSS focused developers there. And I think like with, you know, stuff like Houdini, the people who are more, you know, involved in the CSS community are really going to be able to, like, I don't know, flex their muscles and show the kind of cool stuff that they could do too.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by 1 month. 1 month is online learning courses in which you can learn how to code in, guess how long? 30 days, 1 month. The URL is 1month, all spelled out, .com/shoptalk. Add Shop Talk on the end of that URL because you're going to go to a page to get you 25% off any course you sign up for. They have all kinds of things you can learn there. Python, JavaScript, Ruby. The JavaScript course starts on Monday. Let's say you sign up for 1 month JavaScript. You're going to build 4 projects. One, a GIF search engine using the Giphy API. So real world stuff there, real world JavaScript app building stuff. You're going to build a SoundCloud-like music playing app. You're going to build 2 data visualization apps, and you're going to, you know, you're going to work along over the course of 30 days. Your homework is going to be graded by a 1 month teacher. So it's not like you're just totally on your own here. You have the support of the 1 month staff and teachers. If you have questions, 1 month support is there to help. You are not alone here. You can learn to code. Go check out 1month.com/shoptalk and sign up for one of these courses. It's not even just the ones I mentioned. There's React, there's jQuery, there's WordPress. So much stuff to check out there. Go do it. Level up as a programmer. You're not going to regret it. Cool. So, I mean, how do you fall on this? Now that you've done a bit of a CSS dive kind of thing, are you still occasionally compelled by the idea of the things that avoid cascade, like doing everything with a utility library or doing CSS modules or one of those, do all your styling in JavaScript kind of thing? You come from that world. Is that not?
I am very much an it depends kind of person. So I hate to, like, I feel like that's the politically correct kind of cop-out answer, but it is very much the truth. Like, I don't know, it just depends on so many things. Like, what does your team like to do? Because your team has to be in agreement and they all have to like this. But I definitely just, I think it's important to have an understanding of why things are the way they are in CSS so that you can make an educated decision. Like, you know, global variables in CSS, those are a good thing because, you know, we want to have like that escape hatch where we can have like one variable to represent this color to, you know, tweak it across the entire site. And, you know, you don't want to have that just like on a component level. So it's important, like, you know, like a lot of the like frameworks we can use in JavaScript to, you know, write our CSS in JavaScript, like they do have those escape hatches. So I think that kind of stuff is important. And, you know, like you can get around some of the specificity issues with some of these libraries, but I think it's still important to understand, you know, how specificity works so that you can debug stuff better and, like not use your tools as a crutch, like use them to make things better, but not because you don't have an understanding.
So do you remember, as right now, I know you have a new job and maybe aren't as day to day into it, but still, I'm sure it comes up and stuff. And, you know, we're all Dave and I write CSS, I imagine, on almost a daily. What was the last thing that you remember CSS debugging? Like, even if it's just benign, boring, day-to-day something, did you last CSS change you had to think about and execute?
I feel like the z-index thing is the thing that comes up the most. Like, that's, I don't know, whether it's, like, somebody taps me on the shoulder and they'll ask, like, hey, can you take a look at this? And, yeah, that's definitely, like, the most recent thing that I've looked at and probably the most common thing. That and have, you know, why do I have to put important on something and trying to get out of not doing that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's some kind of important.
Yeah, thing. like why am I having to add important here? Unpacking that.
Trying to look and see ones that I was like, oh, that was a dumb bug. I think one of them was, you know how you can set the border radius in about 100 ways, but one of the, you know, you can pass it four values, and then it, that affects each of the four corners individually. Yep. In border radius. And then I couldn't remember and got it wrong. Which is the first one? Is it, because it's always top, right, bottom, left, but what's top when they're corners? So
yep.
Does it start at the top left or does it start at the top right? And for some reason, my brain always assumes it starts in the top right for some reason, but I think that's wrong.
Oh, I'd have to look it up too. I don't know off the top of my head. I would think it starts at the top right too. Is it the top left?
I think it's the top left.
Maybe because we read like left to right. Maybe that's a good way to think about it.
What was the last CSS thing you had to debug, Dave?
I've been blogging a lot, some of it's on the blog, but card UIs, you know, cards, and you put a border around a thing, and then you put it up there, and then people say, oh, the cards aren't the same height, and you're like, oh yeah, okay, I'll just fix that. And then, like, you use JavaScript and you hate that. So you're like, oh, maybe I'll use Flexbox. And then Flexbox, you're like, oh, okay, you gotta like do Flexbox, but then everything has to be a Flexbox. So they're like the children inside the cards all align together when they go next to each other. Okay, I got that. And then you're like, well, grid, right? Grid's a thing. So I'm going to use grid instead because that's better than Flexbox. So you use grid, and then you find out grid doesn't have subgrids at all.
No subgrids.
So, back up. Okay. So I'm going with Flexbox. Wonderful. Awesome. Looks good. I got this card laid out. You know, it's wonderful. And then you open it in IE, like any IE 10 is kind of the worst. And you open up in 10 and it's like, oh, surprise, IE 10 doesn't support flex basis, like, or percentage values for flex basis. And you're like, ah, bless you. And let's find a way to do this. And so like, you just, it's like this, I don't know, kind of like a pinball game, right? Where you get, and then you get it working in old IEs, and then you pull it up in a new thing, and it's like, doesn't work. And so you're like, ah.
Isn't Safari kind of like the new IE too, as far as a lot of this stuff?
Safari 8, which has like a kind of a surprising market share because you think everyone updates their iPhones, but Safari 8 is still kind of hanging around. And it's missing some things, and it's kind of the big surprise machine for me. Like IE10 is like, yeah, I know it's going to be broke. We're just going to do our best there. But like, you know, people still kind of expect it to work really good on an iPhone 8 or like iOS 8. And you're just like, oh boy. Okay. Let's see what we can do here. So
I had one today where I'm like working with this library that it blasts out some stuff into the DOM that has inline styles on it that looks like whoever designed this thing was trying to be very helpful, you know, being like, okay, you don't need a style sheet for this to basically work, mm-hmm. No CSS at all. We're not going to just leave you on your own here. But unfortunately, that the styles that they put on the stuff are a little bit heavy-handed. They're not even like how it looks, but they're positional. And then I'm like, oh, so now I kind of have to use that important.
Because now that it's in line. Oh,
yeah.
I was thinking the other day, I was like, is add important the best or the worst feature of CSS? I mean, you know what I mean? It's kind of like
Well, what's tricky about it's people pseudo think of it as a specificity buster, but it's not. It has nothing to do with specificity. It breaks specificity at a rule basis, not a selector basis, which is weird.
Yeah, well, and it's pseudo for style. You know, it's just basically like, no, I know what I'm doing. Do it, you know, and I don't know if that's the best or the worst thing. It's the worst when somebody else writes it. It's perfect when I write it.
Yeah.
I like it.
And then specificity still matters, because if a more specific rule also has an important rule, it does still win. You know, it's like the most.
But if you know how to use it, you use that to your advantage. You're just like.
There was a post on CSS Tricks a while ago, a guest post years ago, that was some, I forget their names. It was like two fellas who found like 32 ways to override something, and they formulated as spy versus spy. So it was like this spy was black and this spy was white, but they found a way to swap them with a little bit more specificity, and then a little bit more specificity, and a little bit more specificity, and then important, and then a transform on an important, and then, you know, like they were all like legitimate steps up the chain, you know, and not in a way that could be done infinitely. Oh, it was fascinating. There's so many ways in CSS.
I want to read this now. That sounds really awesome.
It's good to know there's only 32 circles to that hell. Another thing I was we talked about layout paint or whatever. I was doing like, I wrote a blog post, but like animated SVG charts. And I was using that where you transition, you know, the stroke dash
offset
on a path and you like draw it, you know? And I was like, oh, this is going to go great. Beautiful. And I did it and it was wonderful. And then like, you know, of course somebody pulls up in Safari and they're like, doesn't work on my phone or it's not animating, you know? And it's like, oh, well, okay. It should work on the $1,500 phone. So let's see what we can do. And I found out like, oh, you have to like trigger a layout. Like that was part of it. Like that kind of like, you have to select something. And I use like path.get bounding client rect to get the layout. It was a hell of a time trying to get it all to work. I found that in a Jake Archibald post, but like kind of went through everything. But what's weird is when you enable it in Safari, you break Edge. Like that was the thing too. God. Like, so you fixed Safari and now Edge is like, oh, well, I guess I won't animate because you called the layout when I wasn't expecting or something. And so it was just like,
case oh, fail.
No. Yeah, basically like I'm stuck between two browser bugs, you know, and I did like figure out like a weird.
I recommend user agent sniffing in that scenario.
Well, yeah, no, I was getting close to that. And then I think it's like a, you know, the transition on a path implementation in Edge is still technically like private in beta, you know? So there may be some bugs or something there. But it's weird. But like, if I added a class to the SVG, heyo, everything's working, you know. But I actually think like Edge is okay. It's actually Safari that's wrong. In the hack to fix Safari breaks Edge. Does that, you know? It's, and so that's the world we live in, America. So. World. The hack you use to fix one thing breaks another thing. But that's the beauty of CSS too.
Absolutely.
So
it's amazing what you can make us think of it when you force us to think deep CSS.
So Amy, I'm curious, since you are from the JavaScript land, what's your view on this JS in CSS or CSS in JS trend happening?
Yeah, again, so there's like trade-offs there. We talked about this kind of stuff a lot on JavaScript Jabber, and I feel like it depends on the team. So if you have a team of developers and they feel pretty comfortable with CSS, then I would say, I don't know, I could go in a lot of different directions here. Like, if it was me, then I would prefer just starting with CSS and... Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like the component-based stuff and writing, you know, CSS, you know, in JavaScript. I don't know. I kind of like the separation of like actually writing CSS and having just my good old fashioned, I don't know, I'm repeating myself, like my good old fashioned CSS and not having to like rename my properties because they're actually JavaScript properties. And yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's my take on it, is I'm a little old fashioned.
Yeah. A little more separation to your concerns.
I mean, I like, even like in, you know, I'm okay with having like, you know, like JSX, like that's totally fine, but I don't like, you know, and I know you like with JavaScript, like obviously I can put like my styles in a separate page or, you know, like import them, but I like the idea of actually writing CSS and not having to write, you know, JavaScript as my CSS.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Good, good. I like
you that. Heard it here first. CSS is the future.
It really is. I think so.
Well, cool. We did it. Let's wrap it up, Amy. For those who are not following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
So I am at Amy_Knight on Twitter, but I spell my name weird. It's Aimee_Knight, KNIGHT. I don't think I have a way for people to give me money. Okay. But, you can just, I don't know, send me.
Tune nice into the JavaScript Jabber podcast.
There you go. You can send me nice thoughts, or I don't know. I will say this as a newer developer, if you listen to this and for some strange reason you feel compelled to do something nice for people, go find people in your community to mentor, because I have had incredible mentors, you know, in my little bit of time, you know, programming, and they have given just out of like the goodness of their heart time, free time to me, and it has been so valuable. So maybe do that instead.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. And follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one. And Chris, somebody actually wants to tell us about a job today.
Hey, we got a job opening to tell you about. The place is called Series 8. They are a small, remote digital product studio. So they have a team spanning the UK and Europe. It's a remote role, but Europe. And they have tons of great clients. They produce beautiful work. Go check out the website, series8.com, and look at what you're in for here. Wonderful kind of motion-based work. They're looking for a senior front-end developer / full-stack developer to lead the next stage. So they say they are leaving their formative years as a small studio. And have grown up a bit, which is great, in just a few years with some awards they've won along the way, which is great. So you are to work with them, you know, you care about semantic HTML and pure CSS, or you work with SAS a bit. You have a little bit of work with some JavaScript frameworks like Vue and React. You're into performance and fast loading sites. You know how Git works. You know, you're a positive person who enjoys communication and you love to learn, and you're into CSS animation and have some CMS experience. These Craft and Shopify and things. So this is you know, if you're into that, if that sounds like you, if you are a senior front end developer who can work remotely from Europe, shoot over a CV to jobs@series8.com, or, you know, check out more by visiting this actual job posting itself, which we'll have a link to in the show notes, or the Series 8 website itself. So go for it, folks. Get this job.
And I think that's going to do it for us. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
JobTalkShow.com.